This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. It's our Health and Living segment and I'm Meera Sivasothi. We have been grappling with a condition here in the country. It's called, of course, better known to us as dengue. And numbers have risen by 100% over the corresponding period in 2014. In fact, dengue has to date resulted in a 100% increase in deaths over that period. And the number of cases reported this year is close to about 50,000. I don't know. We have the officials from Ministry of Health in the studio with us to give us more updates on that. And we're also going to be discussing MERS, which is the Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome coronavirus, which was first identified in humans in Saudi Arabia in 2012. And the majority of cases have been in the Middle East. Until not too long ago, I think Malaysia was had the first case of MERS in Asia, after which South Korea and Philippines and Thailand and all of them have also reported cases. The WHO has been notified of about 1,368 laboratory confirmed cases of infection with MERS, including at least about 487 related deaths. So we have in the studio with us Dr. Rose Nani-Mudin, who's a public health physician and epidemiologist from the head of the vector-borne disease sector, and Dr. Sukhvinder Singh Sandhu, who's an infectious disease surveillance section from the Disease Control Division, both from the Ministry of Health Malaysia. Here to answer your questions, we have opened up the phone lines. The number is 0377109000. You can tweet BFM Radio or text 0162019000 with a question if you have any on MERS or dengue. Welcome to the show. How are both of you today?
Yeah, hi, Meera.
Okay, I'm going to start with MERS, actually. MERS was, as I said, first identified in 2012, Dr. Sukhvinder. Yes. How have we, and we reported our first case sometime last year in the state of Johor. What have we done since then to sort of curb the spread of the MERS?
Okay, actually the first case of MERS queries was reported from Malaysia was in April 2014. This was basically a pilgrim who actually returned back from his pilgrim from Saudi Arabia. Subsequent to that, once we already notified WHO, we actually enhanced our preparedness and response for MERS queries. Prior to the first confirmation of the case in Malaysia, we have actually initiated our response for MERS queries for screening purposes, whereby since we reported in 2012, we already actually started doing screening at the point of entry or all international point of entry for all the persons actually coming from Middle East countries which is currently having this active transmission of the diseases. Subsequent to that, we also have actually started distributing health alert card, especially to those people who return back from Middle East who have mild symptoms but who do not require for admissions. We actually give them health alert card who actually advise them what to do and in case the symptom worsens or subsequently who to call and who to refer to. Following that, we also have actually updated our Ministry of Health facilities and also the private centres where we actually have come up with the guidelines to tell them how to actually diagnose a person to have, we call a person under investigation for MERS COVID and how are the steps to be taken once you confirm a person to have PUI, a short term for person under investigation for MERS COVID, and subsequently, how do you manage these patients in the hospitals?
Okay, so you have the health alert cards, yes, and you have a screening system at airports,
yes,
when passengers are coming from the Middle East. But how do you? What are you looking for? Everybody with a fever, or what are you screening for?
Okay, usually as they come at the international airports, usually we have these thermal scanners, whereby if the temperature is above a certain level, the scanner will actually pick them up. We will actually have medical staff actually stationed at the center, so actually will pull them to the side and actually will interview them and ask them the history and do some medical checkup. And in case they find that this person actually has fever and the symptoms are actually warranting for further investigation, they will be transferred to a respective hospital following consultation with either with ID physician on call or physician on call. And once they have been transferred to the hospitals, is where they'll be kept in the isolation room, and then they will actually do the full checkup for them, whereby they actually will take a sample for investigations. Mostly is lower respiratory tract sample. And then these samples will actually be sent for what we call it as for real-time polymerase chain reaction testing. It's basically a molecular test to actually look for the RNA of the virus. Once they are actually detected to have positive, this patient will be sent to a identified hospitals which actually just manages the confirmed cases. And then the same sample which actually was detected positive for this RNA for this MERS-CoV will be sent for second sampling at Institute of Medical Research for second confirmatory test.
That sounds like a long process.
Yes, it's a long process.
Really long. How do you tell the difference between the ordinary flu and MERS? Because the symptoms are very similar.
Actually, basically, the coronavirus, the
what is
common
corona?
Presentation is common common flu, core flu.
What do you mean by coronavirus?
Coronavirus is basically is a group of viruses which are responsible for acute respiratory infections. It's a very they say broad group, and one of the severe lineage of this virus is the one actually we experienced in 2003, which is known as SARS. Mm-hmm. But there's a very extreme of this group. And MERS coronavirus is basically a novel virus, which is first detected in 2012. Prior to this, it was basically detected among the animals, especially the camels and bats.
Okay, yes. And do we know very much, as we still haven't confirmed whether or not where this virus comes from, which makes our lives a little bit more difficult.
Yeah, that's true.
But there is some rumour that it could come from the camels and farms and stuff like that. And the Hajj period is coming up next September, I believe,
yes.
In a month plus. What is your advice to people who are going to perform the Hajj?
Actually, Ministry of Health is actually working closely with Tabung Haji Malaysia, whereby all these people who are actually going for Hajj, they have to be registered under Tabung Haji. And before these people actually send over to Saudi Arabia to perform their Hajj, we have actually organized a national level briefing for all the medical personnel who will be actually accompanying these Hajj pilgrims people to Saudi Arabia. And at the same time, we also invited all these people who are involved with handling these people for Hajj, and we already given a briefing regarding MERS-CoV, what are prevention precautions they're supposed to take. And then we also work closely with the medical officers in the sense that we actually give them advice of actually do not, we strictly emphasize do not allow these Hajj people to actually visit the camel farms, do not indulge in the raw, uncooked meat or urine or milk of the camels, because initially, and it was reported that camel is a source for this infection. And then we also distribute free masks, gloves, and also we address it on personal hygiene. And then if in case you develop any symptoms like cough, flu during your Hajj, to seek immediate treatment, because we do send our medical personnel over there, so you can at least take treatment from them.
Okay, all this time it seemed like MERS was not something to be concerned about, not too much. You know, it's like a virus, like the flu virus. Only some people are more at risk more than the others. Would you agree with me?
Actually, if you look at the outbreak trend, MERS-CoV actually affects everybody, from a child to adults and to elderly persons. But those who are elderly and immunocompromised, they are the ones who are actually more prone for severe infection of MERS-CoV. Because if you realize that the mortality rate for MERS-CoV is about 35%, and mostly is seen among the elderly groups or those who are immunocompromised. Whereas if you are in the younger age group or you're healthy, you might just have mild symptoms or you may not develop a disease at all.
So can you be infected with the MERS virus and not be ill?
The possibility is there, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And if you do, it could just seem like the ordinary flu.
Yes.
Ah, that's a danger, isn't it? Because then you do not know the number of people you're actually going to be infecting who come in contact with you. Yeah. That's a problem.
Yes, that's right. That's why we ask the general public to be more vigilant and be alert. And the moment you suspect you're not feeling well, seek immediate treatment. Because the moment you walk into any government or private facilities, we have this fever triaging center, where at there they actually will question you and they screen you for fever.
Okay, but then a lot of us see general practitioners. Are they, you know, briefed that, you know, if these
yes,
symptoms
Ministry
come
of Health actually is closely working together with private practitioners, and also we actually in the process of distributing this guidance to all the private clinics invite them whenever we have briefing for this MERS-CoV, and they're always invited to join us. And on and off, we do take up press statement, press release, and we also frequently update our Ministry of Health website to actually to get everybody aware of what's happening.
All right. Okay. And so I suppose the only difference is to take the history as to whether they have been to the Middle East or not.
Yes, right? Middle East or other African countries.
Sure. South Korea has had more than 30 deaths from MERS, the largest number outside of the Middle East so far.
Yes, that's true.
The government has been accused for not curbing the spread. How do we learn from that experience and ensure that it doesn't happen? Or do we know where South Korea dropped the ball?
The moment the South Korea actually had the outbreak of MERS-CoV, WHO actually sent a team over there to actually to investigate the cause of it. And at the end, they came out with five conclusions. And one of them was that there was low level awareness between the public and also the medical practitioners, regarding MERS-CoV. And secondly, there was suboptimal infection prevention control measures that have been practiced in the hospitals in South Korea. And thirdly, there's this phenomenon
suboptimal called... Suboptimal meaning?
In the sense that usually when you handle or you... The moment you handle any person which have infectious disease, you are supposed to adhere to infection prevention control measures in the sense that you're supposed to wear gloves, wear the mask, wear the aprons. But in South Korea, they found that most of the healthcare workers were not actually practicing this to the optimal level.
Okay.
And thirdly, there's a phenomenon known as hospital shopping or doctor shopping, whereby they go to a center, if they don't get well, they actually go to another hospital or another clinic to get treatment. And fourth factor is overcrowding of the emergency hospitals or the wards, whereby this patient was actually placed for too long, which caused the infection to be spread. And last, the final factor was, okay, I actually can't remember.
That's okay. It'll come back to you. But okay, found it quite bizarre that as soon as South Korea had its first case, medical practitioners were scrambling to want to be the first to treat that patient. And I thought that was really quite bizarre. this is the first of its kind. And, you know, people actually wanted to be the ones to treat the patient. But it got out of control after that. Do do they have it under control now?
Currently, if you look at the reporting by WHO, because WHO frequently updates on their website the number of cases reported, for the past few weeks, the numbers have been reported have actually dropped drastically compared to the beginning of the weeks where you can have about four or five cases be reported. I think for the past 1 to 2 weeks, there's hardly one or two cases been reported. And the number of deaths are also actually, stable or stagnant for the time being.
Okay.
So it looks like the outbreak has been curbed.
And see, the other thing is air travel. It's benefited us. It has also been a disadvantage to us in situations like this. So even if you have not been to the Middle East, chances are you could be in the same plane with somebody who is infected with MERS. So what's your advice to people like that?
Actually, the MERS-CoV infection can only spread once a person is at infectious state. That means you actually have the symptoms. If it's asymptomatic, the chances of spreading is minimal. Only once you have developed symptoms,
such as fever.
Fever, cough, respiratory shortness of breath, this kind of assess symptoms, then there are higher chances of them actually spreading the disease. So if you suspect that a person in your plane actually is coughing or unwell, you can actually ask the stewardess in the plane to actually provide a mask or maybe isolate the passenger in case there is space in the plane. And once you actually disembark from the plane, you can actually go and get yourself checked up.
Okay, all right then. Oh, that's going to be quite a tough one, isn't it?
Yeah.
Getting a mask and insulting the person next to you could just be coughing.
Yes.
For the sake of coughing. All right, okay. So I think you'll be able to tell the difference between a significant cough and just an ordinary cough. Anything else, Dr. Rose, you want to add on to MERS by any chance? I know you're pretty much a dengue specialist, but do you have anything else to add on to MERS before we move on to dengue?
I think Malaysia has an experience with the SARS in the year 2001. This is quite similar with the MERS because the transmissions is a direct contact. And I think for Malaysia, from our side, we already have some contingency planned on how to overcome this type of disease. So I hope our public also will be aware on how to prevent this disease. That is the most important. Mm-hmm.
I think the one thing I learned from SARS is the power of hand washing.
Yes.
Crucial. Go out, come back, wash your hands.
Cleanliness.
There is absolutely nothing wrong with washing your hands. We'll come back up next and discuss dengue. We have had a 100% increase in deaths over the corresponding period in 2014. What has caused this increase or spike in dengue cases in the country over the last 1 year? If you have a question, our phone lines are open at 03-7710-9000. You can tweet BFM Radio or text 016-201-9000. Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sivasuthi. It's our Health and Living segment. In the studio with us, Dr. Rosnani Mudin, who's from the public health. She's a public health physician and epidemiologist, head of the vector-borne disease sector in the Ministry of Health Malaysia, and Dr. Sukhvinder Singh Sandhu, who's from the infectious disease surveillance section in the disease control division from MOH as well. And they're here to answer your questions on MERS, which is the Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome coronavirus, or dengue, which, you know, we're going to start that discussion on dengue now. Once again, give us a call, the number 03-7710-9000. Dr. Rose, it has been reported that, you know, these numbers have spiked, the number of dengue cases and deaths have spiked in the country over the last 1 year. Do we know why?
Yeah. I think you must understand that dengue is a global issue. It is not only happened in Malaysia. If we see in the whole world, if you see the WHO reports, in 1990s, we only have like 25 countries affected by dengue. But now it has become more than 100 countries affected by dengue. So this also includes Malaysia. And if you see the trend in the world and also in the Western Pacific region, it's keep increasing for the past one decade. So I think it is a global issue. Of course, what we had in Malaysia in the 2014 is we do have a major increase of dengue cases, and this is also contributed by our environment, the cleanliness of our environment, which is not sufficient enough to help us to prevent from the dengue transmissions occurring in our area, and of course the climate, which has been there for many years, and the population movements, population traveling, which is more now because they have like they can travel easier than before. We have like they can travel from one place to other place. We have LRT, we have aeroplanes, we have many.
Modes of transportation.
Yeah, transportations, all sort of transportations, moving from one area to the other area. This also actually contribute the transmissions to be much easier transmitted from one area to the other area. And of course, our behavior, especially in littering. So people, when people throw rubbish everywhere, this actually provides places for the vector, for the Aedes mosquito, to breathe and to lay the eggs, which the Aedes mosquito actually transmits, help the transmissions of virus from one individual to other individual. So actually, maybe we fail to control the mosquito from breeding in our environment.
But why is it so aggressive now? Is there been a change in the strain of the virus, or why is it?
Yes, in the hyper-endemic area, in the country, hyper-endemic country like Malaysia, Thailand, of course, now it's, we call it already in the secondary infection phase. Maybe in the 1990s, we only have primary infections. Primary infections mean where the individual was infected at the first time.
Okay.
So after the first time, when they get infected, they also have the risk of being infected by dengue about three times, because we have four serotypes in the four serotype of the virus. Then one, then two, then three, then four. So for the second infections and onwards, the clinical manifestation become more severe. Because this our body reactions to the antibody also become severe, and
our soldiers become more aggressive. Is that what you're saying? To get this virus because of the first round?
When the secondary infections mean that there will be more complications occur. More okay. complications. So, for people to get more multi-organ failure, they get more at the secondary infections. There's a lot of mechanisms, a lot of theory behind it. But what is important that we see now, people get easier. They get easier getting this multi-organ failure. For example, liver failure, mm-hmm. kidney failure, and sometimes infections in the meningitis in the brain. Mm-hmm. So this is very dangerous to the patients. They can get killed even 1-2 days after the infections occur in their body.
Okay.
So I think we must understand that there is no cure, there is no vaccines, there is no treatment for dengue. So the only alternative that we have is to prevent. So it is very important that we need to prevent the transmissions.
Are we doing enough?
We must understand that dengue, the occurrence of dengue is actually contributed by many factors. The environmental cleanliness, the population movements, the virus itself, the vector, which is very difficult to be controlled by Ministry of Health. And everybody actually must take part in the prevention of dengue. For example, population movement. We must educate the community that if you are being infected by dengue, you must prevent yourself being bitten by mosquitoes so that this virus won't be transmitted to your family, your next of kin or sure. your siblings.
What about the vaccine? Because Malaysia was part of the trial for a French pharmaceutical company, the trials for a vaccine. And based on the trials in other countries, it seems promising. And some countries have decided to take on board the vaccine for the population. And Malaysia has decided not to do that. And I think our health minister has come on to say that, you know, he doesn't think the trials are sufficient in that. That he's not convinced with the results. Am I correct?
Not really. Actually, the vaccine is still undergoing trial in the community, because before we implement these vaccines, we must make sure that the vaccine is safe to be used in humans and it does give a optimum effect to prevent the transmission to occur. These two factors must be we must ensure these things happen before we implement in the community. So I think there's no vaccine yet in the world for dengue. Even WHO have not announced this vaccine for dengue at the moment. So I think a lot of company is doing trial. And in Malaysia, we have like Sanofi, Pasteur company, which they are doing the trial in other 5 countries, including Malaysia. And I think the latest they have come out with their press statements, and the result was quite encouraging. So before we implement in Malaysia, we will have we'll need the vaccine to be registered in our Bureau of Pharmaceuticals committee, and to ensure that this vaccine is safe to be implemented in the community.
Are trials sufficient, or what happens after clinical trials are carried out?
After the clinical trial, we'll have to see the results. And I think not only Malaysia, I think the whole world is waiting for the dengue vaccine, mm-hmm. because we do not have any other tools at the moment. We don't have any antiviral. But, of course, the safety of the community is very important before we implement the vaccine. And we must make sure that there's no adverse effect that will affect the community when we implement the vaccines. And I think Sanofi Pasteur is now doing it at the community because they want to make sure that everything goes on the right track and give us good effect to stop the transmissions in the community. And for Ministry of Health, we will wait for the results, and at the moment also we have our committee, expert committee, to analyze and to look into how, if this vaccine can be implemented in the community, how we're going to implement, which are the group that we need to vaccinate.
Yeah, because you can't be vaccinating everybody, isn't it?
Yeah, and we need to analyze properly and in detail before we implement it in the country.
Okay, Dr. Raj, welcome to the show. Your question?
This is to Dr. Rosnani. I'd just like to inquire.
Yes.
According to WHO report, the dengue infection rate in Thailand is 3 times more than ours.
Yeah.
But however, the death rate in Thailand is 3 times lower than ours. I mean, is there the possibility that the management that we are doing here in Malaysia, something is not right with the way that we treat the dengue patients?
Okay.
That's my question.
Thank you very much, Dr. Raj. We'll answer that on air. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Raj. These are very good questions, because we also propose the questions to Ministry of Health. But I think we must understand that how this reporting done in each country. For Malaysia, any deaths, even they're infected by dengue, and they also deaths which contribute by comorbids, for example, any other heart disease, hypertension, diabetic, we also include in the dengue deaths, as a dengue death. So it is the reporting systems from country to country is different. But however, in Malaysia, we are very cautious, and we take that deaths with even comorbids, we will include as a dengue deaths, because we want to know what are the preventive measures that we can improve in the systems.
What are you saying, that there's a possibility that they could have died from, you know, some other comorbid disease as opposed to dengue, and that is not captured in Thailand? Is that what you're saying?
Well, yeah, maybe because the way of reporting, because some they might take that only dengue without any other diseases,
complications,
they will take as a dengue death. So it depends on the country how they are reporting. But for Malaysia, for your information, that every dengue death is being reviewed at the hospitals within 3 days after the patient died. And after that, all the dengue deaths, each, like we have 174, each of these deaths actually being reviewed at the state level by the state chair. Meeting was chaired by the director of the health state in that particular state. So they will review on where are the area that we can improve, that to prevent the next, I mean, if there's any other patients infected by dengue. So I think even at the national level, we have a committee, our expert, led by all the consultants, the clinicians from all the country, all the states. Actually, they sit together and they look into on how to improve the management. Yeah, but I think the other thing also, at the moment, what we do is we are conducting a survey, a research on why the deaths now is become, they get more complication much earlier than before. If you see in our deaths report, some of the patients, like after 2 days of fever, they get complications. They get multi-organ failure. So we want to know that. Now we are doing the research with the clinicians, the hospitals, and of course with our IMR, Medical Research Institute, mm-hmm. So that we hope that we can get some answer from it.
Okay, that's fine. So we are discussing dengue and MERS. If you have a question for us, the number is 0377-109-1000. You can tweet to BFM Radio or text 0162019000. When we come back, I want to find out more about genetically modified mosquitoes. This was thrown at Malaysia as to whether, you know, it's something we wanted to consider, and we said no. So I have a clip from the CEO of a British biotech company that produces the genetically modified sterile mosquito males. We'll have the discussion up next after the market update on BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Mira Sivasodi. It's our Health and Living segment and we're discussing dengue and the Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome coronavirus. If you have a question for us, the number is 03-7710-9000. You can tweet BFM Radio or text 016-201-9000. With us, Dr. Rosnani Mudin. She's a public health physician and epidemiologist, head of the vector-borne disease sector, and Dr. Sukhvinder Singh Sandhu from the Infectious Disease Surveillance Section, Disease Control Division, both from Ministry of Health Malaysia. I'm going to go straight into a question. Audrey has a question. Audrey?
Yeah, hi. Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
Okay, I'd like to inquire about the papaya leaf extract. Does it work to cure, to help to increase the platelet count for when a person got infected by dengue fever?
Okay, thank you very much, Audrey. All right, bye-bye.
Thank you, bye.
There you go.
At the top of everybody's mind, papaya leaves.
Thank you, Adri. Medical Research of Institute has conducted a research on the papaya leaf juice. So it's actually proved that this juice can help to increase the platelet count in the patients, dengue patients, which actually prevent on the complications to occur. So it is actually proved by a study done in IMR. So I think papaya leaf is also a natural leaf that you can eat, like ulam, you know. So I think there's no harm for you to take.
Okay. So there's no treatment as such. Yeah. You can't go wrong with the papaya leaf. Yeah. Do you boil it or do you chew the leaves?
Actually, it's very bitter.
It is.
What they do is they'll take two papaya leaves and then they blend with, I think, about 250 ml of water. Mm-hmm. And you have to drink it daily. But it is very bitter. You might maybe put a little bit of sugar to overcome the bitterness. And you can drink it every day.
Just two papaya leaves, once a day?
Yeah.
Just once a day?
Blend with the water and drink.
Okay, because sometimes people overdo it because, you know, with these remedies, you don't know how much really to you know, ingest. So two papaya leaves is really the quota for the day. Because I understand some people, it has worked. Platelet count has gone up. But then I'm very skeptical as to whether or not it was the papaya leaves or it was just your immune system kicking in and increasing the platelet count. Yeah. Okay, so no harm is really the message. Genetically modified mosquitoes. Malaysia did consider that. I'm going to play a quick message from the CEO, Hayden Perry, of Oxitec, which is a British biotech company.
The one thing the male is very, very good at, though, is finding females. And wherever your female is, he will find them. If we create our own mosquitoes, if we genetically engineer males to be sterile, then when that female meets a male, if it's one of ours, a little Oxitec male, which she can't tell the difference, then those offspring will die. And they'll die as larvae before they get to being functioning adults. Now, you might think that's a bit odd because they're sterile. So how are we going to produce millions of them? And the answer is because in this genetic engineering, we've made it so that actually if you feed the mosquitoes with a special diet when you're in the factory, they're fertile again. So that means you can just feed them perfectly normally in the water when they're larvae and they'll be fertile and you can create huge numbers. When they go out in the big wide world as males, they don't have that, they're sterile. So if we can put more sterile ones out there, the females are more likely to mate the sterile ones, the population comes down. And in fact, it works very well. It comes down in about 4 or 5 months, down to pretty much close to zero.
Sounds very simple, but why don't we use it then?
Yes, when we do this test in the lab, it's very simple because you can arrange where the male will meet the female. But if you release the male in the real environment, there where you might not control where they fly, and they might meet or they might not meet the female out there. But in the lab, it's very easy because you you release in the same, maybe in the same room, in this where they don't have any other choice. But I do not know. Maybe the mosquito also have preferable the sterile male and the male that they have in the out there
yep.
in the area. So in the lab, it's very easy. Is you can predict what happened. But if you release in the real world, you do not know where this male mosquito will go. Do they meet the female mosquito that you want them to have meeting with the female? And I think they did a test in an island, which they said is a success story. But how much mosquito they have to release is more than 1.2 million male
sterile mosquitoes.
Yeah. So in terms of cost, it's very, very, very high for us to create this sterile male mosquitoes.
Before we come to cost, what is the worst thing that could happen by releasing the sterile mosquitoes, the males?
Yeah, maybe they might not meet the female, and we do not get our objective that this female will mate with the sterile male, and then the offspring will die. So the other thing is we need long-term follow-up also. What could happen with this male sterile male mosquitoes when they are released in our environment
in such large numbers? Yeah. When you talk about cost, actually, I'm thinking, what could be more costly than have people filling up beds in private and government hospitals, as opposed to releasing or trying this out or looking at it a little bit more seriously, because we don't have a vaccine?
Yes, but what could be? It will be much cheaper if you can prevent littering.
We're trying.
Yeah, and then make your environment clean.
We're not successful.
But this is the long term effect that you need. The change of Malaysian behavior that you need. It's not only prevent dengue, but it's also prevent the other diseases. So if you release mosquito, it's only prevent dengue, but the other diseases might be there, like leptospirosis, because our environment is dirty. So why don't we use the cheapest way to prevent all the disease?
Because it's not effective is really the thing, you know.
But we need to change. I mean, it is in our mind and heart. If we don't change, we have to start it from our home.
For some reason, yeah. I think people are unable to link or take seriously the link between cleanliness and dengue.
Yeah.
People are just unable to, in their minds, yeah. make that link that it is serious. It's always the government's problem,
yeah,
because
yes.
you're not managing things
yes.
properly. So, yeah. in terms of cost effectiveness, I don't know. It's entirely up to you. I mean, I'm not sure how much it costs, but releasing 1.2 million yeah. mosquitoes is a lot yeah. of mosquitoes.
Yeah. It's very, very... It's very, very costly, actually. Very, very costly. And I think our way forward, even the Ministry of Health, with other ministries, with other six ministries, we are trying to change, we are trying to implement our cleanliness campaigns and change our Malaysian behavior.
I think you should go straight to the schools, to be honest.
Yeah, yeah. We are doing it now. We are
you've lost
now.
Hope with the rest of yeah, the demographic.
Yeah, yeah.
What are the cost-effective methods besides keeping our homes clean? I mean, and to me, it's a large problem. Are there any other methods which could be cost-effective? If a vaccine comes, do you think that could be one method?
Yeah, even vaccines, it need cost when you implement. But maybe vaccines, if you implement to a 1%, it can help to prevent the infections for this person lifelong. So it is, and you know, and you are sure that the infection will not occur in the vaccinated person. So, but if you release mosquito in the real world, you do not know where this mosquito will go.
Has the genetic diversity of the virus increased? And hence, you know, it is more aggressive.
Yeah, we are doing the study now. We are looking in terms of serotype, it's still the same. Den 1, den 2, den 3, and den 4. But for the genetics evolutions, we are now doing the studies with IMR to see if there's any genetic changes in the severe cases at the moment.
Okay, so that's ongoing.
Yeah.
All right. And fogging, is that really effective?
Well, to overcome the transmissions, to stop the dengue transmission, it is not actually the solutions. But to kill the adult mosquito, it does help in the outbreak area. Because when you have so many of the adult mosquito populations, you need to reduce the population so that you stop the transmissions of virus from one individual to the other individual. So that is a short-term measure. But in a long-term measure, environmental cleanliness is the most important. And the human behavior and do not littering is the most important, actually.
We have a question here. What is the cost of producing millions of mosquitoes? Do we know?
Well, I think it's going to be like billions.
Billions?
Billions. Yeah.
Not just millions, not of ringgit.
Yeah, not million, but it's going to be billions.
That is a lot of money.
Yeah, that's why.
Small, tiny things. How can it cost so much?
Yeah,
is it the environment in which?
No, when you want to develop the sterile mosquito, it is very technically
driven.
Driven, yeah. It is not like you are putting, you have to inject from the mosquito eggs. You have to identify the mosquito from the mosquito eggs and inject how to make the female sterile. So it is very complicated, actually.
It's a very tedious process as well. Okay, we're running out of time. Can I ask you for a message on MERS, Dr. Sukhbinder?
Okay, basically it's for general message for all those travelers either to Middle East or to any countries affected with Muscovy. The basic is always maintain good personal hygiene, because you can never go wrong by maintaining good personal hygiene.
Okay. And Dr. Rose, your message?
Yeah, I think like what you say, Mira, we need to keep our environment clean and to stop the mosquito from breeding and lay the eggs and increase their populations in our environments.
Thank you both very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Rose Nanimuddin and Dr. Sukhbinder Singh Sandhu from the Ministry of Health Malaysia discussing dengue and the Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome coronavirus on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.